This is a Piccolo podcast production.
Welcome to Adam Shant at Large. I'm back from Egypt, a lightning visit of just 8 days with my son. I first promised I'd take him there when he was 12. He's now 30. Sometimes these things happen at the right moment. The timing was in part due to the late Brian Murphy, who died on Anzac Day. On his deathbed, Murphy ordered me to make this trip, even though it meant I'd miss his funeral. Now, it was an amazing trip as we followed the footsteps of my grandfather, who was stationed in Egypt during World War II, and we matched his photographs that he took back in the 40s. There was also an eerie moment when we saw a man who looked exactly like my late father. I'm talking exactly. That's a story for another day. So my thanks go to Murphy for his final edict to me. In our final days together, we also talked about some unresolved issues from his past, including the murder of Sydney brothel heavy Raymond Francis Loxley, whose body was found at Menai, south of Sydney, in May 1979. Murphy always maintained that Rentokil, Christopher Dale Flannery, killed Loxley after a dispute during a road trip to Sydney. Many uncritically accept this, despite the fact that Flannery was never convicted of the murder. In fact, his friend Ray Mooney says Flannery was set up for the murder by police, who verbaled him, including Murphy. We'll hear Mooney's version in full in a later episode, but first I wanted to run my last interview with Murphy, who stuck to his story about Flannery until the very end, and also gave us more of an insight into Flannery the man from their days in the den of iniquity called Mickey's Disco in St Kilda. Everyone deserves the truth to be told about them at least once, even a contract killer like Flannery. So I'll be pursuing this over the coming weeks. In the meantime, enjoy my final interview with the Skull, Brian Francis Murphy. Brian, we're sitting here in your lounge room here in Middle Park, and I think from my memory, Christopher Dale Flannery came to this place and maybe even sat on the sofa where I am now.
That's right.
Is that fair enough?
Quite correct.
When did you first meet him?
I first met him when he went to Mickey's Disco. Ronnie Feeney said, "Listen, I'm taking a bloke up by the name of Chris Flannery." I said, "Is he out of jail from over in Western Australia?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, how'd he get a job here?" He said, "His wife." He said, "He's been working as a milkman, and he wants to get out of that. Because if the coppers see him running around of a night and anything goes wrong, they'll blame him." And he put on Ronnie Feeney to take him on. Now, Ronnie Feeney was on probation to me from a probation officer in Sydney.
Very unusual relationship.
Yeah, but I got along all right with Feeney. Feeney was a good source of information. And the people that came in there were also a good source of information. Some would talk to you, some wouldn't. Some couldn't talk to you quick enough. Frank Green rang Paul Higgins and myself. He said, "I'll give you $150 a week to get in and find out." He said, "That appears to be the bloody cesspool of Melbourne."
Frank Green was the boss of Victoria Police's Bureau of Criminal Intelligence.
He says, "We can't watch them all the time, we can't. The noise is that loud, you can't hear anything that people are talking about. And we want you and Paul to be my ears." And sometimes I might bring him 15 times, this is Frank Green, 15 times a day, not with the lot, but with tidbits.
Because everyone knew who you were. You were the scourge of South Melbourne at the time and probably a few other suburbs.
Yeah.
And here you are mixing with these people. They're all there for villainous purposes or to consort with others. How was the coexistence? That's what I don't understand.
It didn't worry me because I had Frank Green to back me up to say that he asked me to go there. They think that I'm the real Brian Murphy. He's the real Paul Higgins. And they don't give a stuff about the police department. And they opened up. They opened up quite a lot. One night I was at the front door of Mickey's Disco and Chris Flannery said to me, "I guarantee they're fucking coppers over there in the van." What am I going to say? "No, they're not." Straight away, you'll doubt me. I said, "Well, why don't you go and knock on the fucking door and ask them?" Now, the blokes in the van heard it. And they said, "That low bastard, he's sending them over here." And Flannery said, "Pig's ass, they're liable to fucking shoot me." I said, "Well, there you go." So you're stuck with it. Either they are or they're not. And you'll never know unless you go and knock on the door. And I quietened him down, but they went back to Green and said, this bastard, he's doing this, that and the other. That's what I was getting paid to do as a policeman and for Frank Green.
But you're also giving Flannery and I guess others there the idea that, well, I can step across the line here. I might be able to assist you. And that is a good example of it.
Yeah. Chris Flannery was there one night and he said to me, he said, I trust you and Higgins more than these other bastards here. And he did. He told us lots of things, you know, just about his life and about the coppers in Western Australia. A lot of other things that meant not a great deal to me, but would mean something to Frank Green. Now, every time I rang Frank Green prior to doing this, I was still ringing Greeny every day because that was the squad I had. And I was in the county court one day and they asked me a question. I said, well, I told Frank Green. And they said, well, how do you know? How would you know? I said, Greeny used to write up in a book. And the judge said, oh, Murphy's Law. And it was a leather-bound book too, the old-fashioned ones with the leather about 2 inches down from the top and 2 inches from the bottom and the rest was embossed.
Yeah.
And he said, is that book still in existence? I said, I hope so. Anyhow, they called for the book and what I told them in the court was correct. So Green not only took from me, he also took from Higgins. And different things, Higgins would say, do you reckon Greeny knows about that? I said, no. He said, well, tell him. Are you going to tell him or am I going to tell him? And that's the way it worked out. Now, I had Chris Flannery in Russell Street one night and I picked him up and I was questioning him about a murder in Sydney of...
Loxley?
I had him in Russell Street. And I was questioning him. He wouldn't be questioned anywhere near a desk. And he checked me for a tape. I said, I'm not taping you. I'm asking you. Anyhow, we started talking about his kids and he started crying. And this drunken senior sergeant comes into the room with Mrs. Flannery and Mrs. Feeney. And straight away, he's trying to wipe the tears away. I hadn't put a finger near him, but I knew how to get him emotionally upset, you know. And he was telling me about Loxley, how he'd had the cars cleaned 3 times on the way back to Melbourne in those car washers so there'd be no dirt from New South Wales and only Victoria. And I said, oh, yeah. And Kathy come in and she saw him crying and she said, you've been fucking belting him. I said, hey, just quieten down. I said, he's all right. She said, he's saying nothing more to you and he's coming with me. Feeney's wife was as good a girl. She just shut her mouth. She had to come along with her. There's some of the things that happened and down.
So he was basically in the middle of a confession to you about what he'd done.
Yeah.
And why do you think it was? I mean, why do you think you could, as you say, push those emotional buttons with him?
Mate, you've either got it or you haven't. Now, the night that they picked up one of the boys that was charged with the murder of Wilson,
yep,
the barrister from New Zealand.
Yep, Roger Wilson.
Roger Wilson, a solicitor who was murdered in Melbourne.
Yeah, Roger Wilson was a barrister and he was a wheeler and dealer. The chap that they charged with his murder was a solicitor. Now, I'd heard, Feeney had told me they're going to kill a solicitor and abduct him and kill him.
The solicitor charged with Wilson's murder was Mark Clarkson, but he beat the charge, as did Flannery. Flannery's wife, Kath, was also charged, but it was withdrawn before the trial.
I walked in to where they had this fellow, and they got a message from Delanus, don't let Murphy anywhere near him, because he knew that I would get the truth out of him, and I wasn't allowed to go near.
Why would that be a bad thing?
It was all ego with Delanus. The homicide had a bloody ego bigger than Texas, and some shit-kicking detective sergeant coming in and doing their job or getting it out. But I reckon that night he was looking at me, I could see him shitting himself, and he thought to himself, I'm going to be in strife here. And I never questioned him. But they all beat that murder of Wilson. And Alphonse reckons that's the worst job he ever had. He had to go and shift the body. Had to shift the body a couple of times, he said, digging up the body. And
because Flannery had ordered him to go and dig up the body. And
Yeah.
So this is all, this information's now flowing. You're Feeney's probation officer. You're all in Mickey's. There's Ray Mooney. There's Flannery. There's a whole bunch of other
villains
around the town. I mean, what was an average night in there? How would it go?
Well, the music was about as loud as a thunderclap. Chris Flannery, he admired us because we could have a go.
But now, Flannery himself, he'd been in Pentridge, he'd had six times down in H Division,
yeah.
He'd been brutalised beyond belief down
no
there.
No doubt.
And you know, that was the order of the day. But when he comes out, could you see the impact on him? Because he gets harder in there. He gets harder. Well, he was in boys' home initially and got abused there. And he goes. So what was his personality when you met him first?
It was as good as gold. A bit weary of us. One night, I'm on the door of Mickey's, talking to them, and a bloke looks at his wife. She was behind the counter. He says, "You're beautiful." And she called Chris over. She said he was trying to come onto me. He's got a rasp and it's running across this bloke's eyes.
Like a carpenter's rasp.
Yeah. And I come out later and there's this bloke staggering around. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Mate, nothing. Fucking nothing." He knew who Chris Flannery was and he just wandered off into the dark. And I said to Chris, "What happened?" He said, "Nothing." I said, "Good." Which I didn't expect him to say any more. I said, "Fair enough." And then he come to me and he say, "Be careful of that prick over there. He hates you and he'll have a go at you at the slightest option, you know." And sometimes there were brawls there every night and he come running down.
How many were you involved with there?
Several. You had to defend yourself and you had to let the crim see that you weren't frightened to defend yourself.
Give me an example of how that would happen.
Well, there was a blue there one night and Chris ran up an elevated section of the floor, dance floor, and there's a barrier about a metre high and he dived in. There's the melee going on and he dived from the run and he dived into the crowd jumping up. He coped with himself and coped with anybody else and give him just as much as they give him.
He wasn't a big bloke though.
No, no. He was smart as a whip and as game as a hunting dog. He said, "Are you all right?" You know, I was in the middle of it. I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, listen." He says, "I know most of those blokes." He said, "And I fucking quietened them down and I told them to drop off you, leave you alone." And that's how I found him.
Yeah, you had a. It's hard to understand how this hard man who becomes the notorious.
No, he wasn't a hard man.
He wasn't.
No, he wasn't.
Even despite what happened to him in Pentridge.
Yeah, he knew that he was on a good thing here with Feeney. Feeney was paying him plenty. And Kathy was, I think she was doing the books at one stage. And another lady, she was a lovely woman, but they put us down. I reckon he and Feeney were grabbing our wages, right, and splitting them. I didn't give us up because I was getting $150 a week off Frank Green to shout all the crims drinks, and they reckoned it was great.
And you weren't a drinker?
No, I didn't.
So you could buy them drinks?
Yeah.
And then watch the results.
That's right.
And stir things up, manipulate things,
yes.
Set this one against that one. That's fair enough?
And it was the way it was, and that's the way I worked. There were times when I would see things happening, and I'd tell different coppers, because the coppers in there every night of the week getting pissed for nothing. And different blokes were making a welder of it. I'd ring Greeny, and he'd ring somebody and say, "Listen, tell those bastards to wake up to themselves." You know? But he wasn't... as hard as you think he was.
Well, Ray Mooney says that after the dairy, in fact, the dairy's interesting because he ended up beating up the manager, and that's one of the reasons he left there.
Well, I didn't know.
Yeah, he did that, yeah. And then he was looking. And in Ray's version, he wanted to get a job, and that's why he worked in the dairy. Terrible job, low pay, hard work. And so Mickey's was another of that version, a little bit better, but now he's coming into a very ambiguous situation.
That's right. And one where he could make plenty of money if he wanted to. And he did. Now, Finney went and bought a new car, a Merc, He said, what do you think of it? I said, why'd you do that? He said, what, are you jealous of me? I said, I've got a bloody old Ford and it'll do me to the rest of my days. But if I was to buy a new car, first of all, I'd have to justify where I got the money to my wife and to my family. I said, and I can't afford a new car, so I'll keep driving. But I'm going to tell you something. You've bought a new car, you'll have every crim in Melbourne coming to you for bail and for money and for a loan and this and that and the other. He said, you're jealous of me. The next thing, Chris Flannery came to him. He said, I want to get a new car. And he told me, and I said, see what I mean? So he got him a white Mercedes. And at that time, he started a brothel down the back of Jackson Street, on the corner of Ackland Street and Jackson Street.
Flannery did.
Yeah. And I've been to Mass one night with Margaret and the kids. 6 o'clock Mass come out. And it was him. He said, mate, he said, the cops are looking for me. I said, what for? He said, killing Loxley. I said, did you? He said, you shouldn't ask me that. Feeney told me that he had his car cleaned 3 times on the way back from Sydney so they wouldn't find any traces of dirt from the gravesite or anything.
And so Feeney was your main source on Loxley?
Yeah, and Feeney told me that they were going to kill a barrister over a deal that had gone wrong.
That was Roger Wilson.
And so I ran the homicide and I said, you know, like, they're going to kill a barrister and get rid of his body, et cetera, et cetera. And they said, have they killed him yet? Oh, what a joke. I said, no, they haven't, as a matter of fact. They said, well, when he killed him, come and see the homicide then. I said, you can all get fucked. And, of course, it fucking blew up. And I was their best friend. And they wanted to talk to me, and they wanted to find out this, and I was doing that. And that's how I come to be talking to Chris in Russell Street that night. But
right, because eventually this, it's not sustainable. How long was the Mickey's era, by the way? How long did it go for? How long were you associating with Feeney and Flannery and co?
About 12 months, I think.
A very packed 12 months.
Oh, mate, it was packed every night. And
you do your full job.
Yeah.
And then you go to Mickey's at night.
That's right. And they got me and questioned me. And Gwendy said, you keep it to yourself, don't tell anyone you can. And I said, fair enough. I said, what about the bosses? They said, you said they're not to know because a lot of them I can't trust. See? And so I thought, oh, fair enough, because a lot of them I didn't trust. Anyhow, they got me into town one day and they questioned me. And I always answer the questions. Why put yourself in the position of being a criminal and saying I'm not fucking saying anything, you know? And they said, well, why do you go down there overnight? I said, I love disco music. I said, it's fantastic. I said, and I could listen to it all night. And I said, oh, yeah? They said, well, why don't you listen to it home? I said, I like it loud. I said, because it settles me down. I said, and if I play it as loud as I want it, I wake the whole fucking house up. I get in there for nothing. I said, and I get information. They said, what do you do with the information? I said, I send it to the appropriate source. They said, who's that? I said, I'm not telling you. They said, fair enough. Anyhow, I did a 2-page statement on it, and they accepted it. And when I was walking out, this bloke said, you fucking lying cunt. But it's the way it was. I told Greeny I wouldn't tell anybody, and I didn't.
Yeah, and by the end of all this, Flannery's starting to get pretty leery of you. He's now working out that he's moving.
Double dicing him.
Yeah, and he's moving from being a doorman to being a hitman by this time.
That's right.
So what happened in the end of your relationship?
Flannery had done his block one night, must have got drunk or something. He'd fired shots into the couch to terrify his kid, Peter.
His own kid?
His own kid, yeah. Because he was getting a bit smart with the tongue and all this kind of shit, being a kid. Anyhow,
he would have been small at that stage.
Wouldn't have been all that old. Anyhow, I think he had a daughter too.
Yes.
Anyhow, it's a long time ago.
It is.
And after Brownie rang me, these cars appeared opposite his joint. And he got home late from Mickey's and he sees them. And there's another style of car there later. And he said, do you think they're the dogs? I said, go and fucking knock on the window.
again.
And ask him. Yeah. And I'm doing nothing wrong. He knows they're the dogs. He knows they're watching him. So he rings me about 24 hours later. He says, I'm going to Tahiti. I think it was Tahiti anyway. And he said, for a holiday. And the next thing, Erickson rings him.
Thomas Joseph Fabian.
Erickson, pedophile, extraordinaire.
Your nemesis?
One of them. Rotten bastard he was. Anyhow, he said, your fucking mate Murphy has given you up. He's done terrible things about you and all this kind of stuff. He said, I don't believe it. He said, I'm fucking telling you the truth. Because Erickson used to live down at Frankston. They were taping his lines. So he come back. And one afternoon, I said to Margaret, I've got to go and see a bloke. I won't be long. And she's cooking in the kitchen, cooking cakes and all that kind of stuff for the kids' lunches. And there's a ding-dong at the door. When I walked out, I saw this white Mercedes parked along the beach. And they usually don't park where traffic's going to come out. Anyway, I just went out of my head and I went and saw this fellow. And he said, I'm supposed to see Brian. She said, well, we'll be back in a minute. Would you like to come in? She had no fucking clue who he was. And he says, I'm Chris Flannery. I had an appointment to meet Brian here today. She said, but he didn't say anything to me about it. She said, but come in if he's got an appointment with you. And he said, all right. So they sat down here and Margaret said, would you like a cup of tea? And she did him a cup of tea or coffee, whatever it was. And she just finished making a cake, so she had hot cake for them and they thought it was lovely. But to get a view of the house inside, he'd gone to the toilet. Could I use your toilet, please? So she said yes. Then he comes out, washes his hands, comes into the kitchen and speaks to Margaret. And not a word out of place. And then she comes down and does the same. They come back up here. My mate, who was a solicitor, had the run of the house. And I was a very close friend of his. And he comes in to get one of those books over there.
Off the shelf, yeah.
He stands up and this Dill thinks he's a copper because the gun falls off out of his trousers and he picks it up and puts it in his belt. And he thought he was a copper. So
he just, Flannery stands up and the gun
falls out on the floor.
Bang.
There. Mm. And he said, I've just got to get this book. I'll see you later. And he thinks, after his second cup of coffee, that this bloke would tell Margaret he's got a gun up there. But he didn't. Wouldn't mean a thing to him. He seemed pleased when he was with the guns. He comes down and he said, look, we can't wait any longer. I think we'd better get going because he thinks other coppers are going to come here. So she ushered him up to the front door and took the dishes down, washed them, put them away. I come home and she said, Chris Flanner's been here. I said, what did he want? He said he had his wife and everything with her. And she said, And I sat him down. I said, good, good, good. I wouldn't castigate her for being a decent person because she'd done nothing wrong. Anyhow, I rang a bloke and I said, Chris Flannery's just been here and a gun fell out of his trousers on the floor. I said, get all your fucking gear and meet me and bring my guns down. And at that time, I think I was carrying a gun, but anyhow, they come here. And he went straight out of the airport and got a plane to Sydney and never come back. But
so you think he was coming here to shoot you?
Yeah.
And then he thought you were going to back up and shoot him?
Yeah, that's right.
Probably both were correct, don't you think?
One way or another, I think so. And
the fact that he'd come to you, crossed your family threshold, and potentially put Margaret at risk, that must have made you pretty determined.
Pretty pissed off. And there's no doubt, if I had grabbed him that night, I'd have locked him up. And he would have told me why he was here. And there wouldn't have been a punch thrown. Because I didn't have to with him. Thomas Joseph Fabian Erickson was colouring in the water. He was stirring him up. Because Erickson was frightened of me and thought, well, I'll kill two birds with one stone here. But he was a terrible piece of business.
He was. He lost a leg. And died in hospital. I think you gave him a final send-off with a phone call that you may recall or not.
I did.
What did you tell him?
I rang the hospital and I said, my name is John Curtin. I'm a Carmelite priest from Middle Park, who was his cousin or close relative. And I said, I'd like to speak to Tom. I said, I believe he's very, very ill. And he said, and they said, well, we'll get the phone to him. And he said, hello, father. I said, you fucking big fat I said, you're a fucking dog, and I'm ringing you before you fucking die. And I just hung up on him. And but before I hung up, he's saying, you fucking Murphy, I'm a Waker, you fucking dog. I thought it was rather funny.
I think there was a reference from you to taking his remaining leg and stowing it in a place where he could use it as a
where the sun doesn't shine.
Yes, he can make a little stool out of it.
Yeah, that can be a bit tricky.
So Flannery, though, he takes off. He's never to be seen in Melbourne. In fact, if you locked him up, I wonder whether... Listen, I think he was heading for a demise of some kind, an early one. But the move to Sydney was his undoing, obviously.
Because he was told to be quiet, and he's told by... Rogerson, all of them, behave yourself up here. But he couldn't help it. He got up there and wanted to be Mr. Big. And he had McPherson and all those bastards up there, and they weren't going to take this bastard. But she finished up going up to the Rain Tree Forest up in Queensland.
Yep.
And she started a car renting business called the Jolly Green Frog. One night, Billy Maloney, his brother was shot on the toilet by the toe cutters, and Billy Maloney came to Melbourne, and Billy Maloney went to a nightclub up there, and he said the lovely Kathleen was driving him home from the nightclub, and a gun felt come out from under the seat. Jesus, he says, what are you doing that for? She says, I'm fucking waiting for Murphy to try and kill me, and I'm going to fix him. Yeah.
Was that your plan?
No. I couldn't give a stuff about her. She was a terrible piece of work. And I hope her kids turned out all right, like apparently Chuck's kid has.
Right, Chuck Bennett's kid, yeah.
Yeah, because she didn't deserve to have them.
Yes. No. Okay. Flannery, though, he's become the most notorious hitman in Australia, Rent-A-Kill. Everyone, you know, he's been dead a long time, and still people talk about him. I mean, you know... Yeah. What's your attitude to the legend about him?
I don't reckon he killed as many as he's supposed to.
You don't think he had it in him?
I think he had it in him. I think at the right time he could do his block and shoot you.
But I think that beating and brutality in Pentridge set him up for it.
Brutality in anywhere. And not only that, his brother, Dancing Ed Flannery,
lawyer.
Was a lawyer, and he used to say to me, it's not Chris's fault. I said, you're his brother. He said, I know. He said, I know you. He said, and I don't believe you've ever done a thing to hurt Chris, and he admires you. And
probably misplaced, given that you were trying to lock him up for murders.
That's right, but that was my job, you know, and... poor old Roger Wilson, he didn't deserve what happened to him. He was the son-in-law of a mate of mine, and that's just how it goes.
Yep, live a violent life and meet a violent end.
And that's what I said to somebody the other day when George Joseph died. I said he had a better death than the fellow up in Wiffus.
Donald McKay?
Yeah.
Because Joseph had supplied the weapon...
Yeah.
To Donald Baisley.
And was in plenty.
Jim Baisley, sorry.
Jimmy Baisley. Mm. And that's another story for another day.
Another story for another day, indeed, yeah.
That was the very last interview I did with Brian Francis Murphy. He passed away on Anzac Day this year, and I thank him very much for his friendship and the stories he told me. I'll be following up a few more, I guess, as I try to unravel some of the stories he didn't tell me, but that's definitely an exercise that we'll be pursuing. And by the way, as we've told you, we'd like to get a sponsor for this podcast. If we're going to continue making these stories about things that you haven't heard of, the stories that don't make it into the media, that you don't know, we do need to have some financial support. So get in touch, sponsor Adam Shant at Large. We'll be taking a break shortly for a couple of weeks while we tidy things up and get our sponsorship in place. But thank you for all your support, and we look forward to bringing you more stories very soon. Thanks for listening. I'm Adam Shant.